This is the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester. And tonight, my guest is the co-author with Robert Silverberg of When the Blue Shift Comes, told in two novella-sized parts. His short fiction has appeared in Galaxy's Edge, edited by Mike Resnick. He's also published like numerous reviews, critical essays and interviews all over the place. He's been on SF Signal, Strange Horizons, the New York Review of Science Fiction, the Internet Review of Science Fiction, Foundation, Salon Futura, and other places. So you can probably find him out there. And he's a previous finalist of the Writers of the Future contest. I'm speaking of Alvaro Zainas Amaro.
I love the question mark in your tone. Yes, you are. You are indeed.
Who I met.
Your prize, dear sir.
Who I met at a Worldcon several years ago. Alvaro and his co-conspirator and sometimes editor, which means girlfriend, currently reside in sunny Irvine, California. I'm not going to hold that against him, but I am sorry. And I might send you flowers at some point. How the heck are you?
I am doing very well.
Yeah?
And I'm doing better now that I heard my name pronounced correctly.
It's a long-running joke on the podcast that I never pronounce everything. That's actually why I have John Anilio. I make him pronounce all the names on Functional Nerds.
Is that all the reason, or is there?
Well, after I got the theme song from him, kind of, yeah.
Thoughtful pause, right?
So, what's up? What's going on with you? You actually sent me an email, and I guess you're a listener to the podcast, and that's always cool. I like it when people, you know, actually pay attention. So that makes three so far. And you've kind of made a big splash because you get to write something with Silverberg. That's kind of awesome.
It sure is. I think, you know, obviously we met at a Worldcon a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and I had been listening to the podcast before that and continued to listen to it even after I'd met you, which was...
Yeah, that doesn't always happen.
Right? But I think my relationship with the podcast, if I'm not mistaken, may be a little bit similar to Gail Carriger's. I think you had mentioned that she would argue with the podcast, yell or whatever it was, you know, have these very strong opinions. And it just got to the point where I thought, you know what? I know this guy. I'm going to send him an email. It's been several years, but he may vaguely remember me. And so here we are. We find ourselves.
So what have you been doing in the meantime? So you had the book with Silverberg. Is there other stuff you've been working on?
Absolutely. So that was, as you said, a two novella project. It's part of the Stellar Guild where they pair up up and coming authors with more established prose. And in most of those books, it's sort of a longer novella and then a novelette. But I got to do 50-50, and I was very excited and lucky about that, because what that meant, among other things, was that we were able to sell the book to the UK. So Golance actually brought it out 2014, which was wonderful. And it's almost presented sort of like a collaborative, you know, novel or single story told in two sections. One of the things that I realized after that book had come out and I answered some questions about it and so on and so forth was that for years now I've been having these conversations with Silverberg that I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one that would find them of interest if other people got to hear them or, you know, be participants in them. And so the Blue Shift book turned out quite well, at least, you know, in our estimation as far as what we were expecting it to do. And it was just, more importantly, it was a very pleasant experience. And just from a professional standpoint, particularly for me. Bob sort of sent me his novella, and not to give too much away about the story, but it's far future set, and at the end of his novella, essentially the universe is placed in great jeopardy, and he sort of leaves it all in a state of, you know, imminent doom and disrepair. And he sort of sent me the whole thing, and he's like, "Well, have fun with that, kid. Figure it out. No pressure. No pressure at all."
You know that I thanked him in my Hugo Award speech.
Oh yes, that's right.
Yeah, I thanked him for always doing his thing after the Fan Awards.
Right.
If I'd been able to go to London, I actually had an alternate speech that was essentially a audition that if at any time he was unable to come to a Worldcon for some reason and do his speech that tortures all the writers, that I would totally be willing to do that for him.
That would be fantastic. I hope that happens someday.
Can you imagine just giving me free reign with a microphone on the Hugo stage? That this would not end well.
Yeah, I kind of can, and it's a scary. So, as a result of that, there's a new project underway right now to finish answering your question, which is a book of transcribed conversations. It's called Traveler of Worlds: Conversations with Robert Silverberg. That's coming out in 2016, and it's going to be coming out from Patrick Swenson's bringing it out on Fairwood Press.
Very cool.
So that's definitely been keeping me busy.
So what's it like having Robert Silverberg as a pen pal?
it's both fascinating, incredibly rewarding, slightly unnerving, challenging. You could just continue adding adjectives to that list, as you can probably imagine. It is one of those things where, I mean, as part of the prep for this book, and just to let you know, most of the conversations we're actually having live at his home, and I'm recording them, and then I'm transcribing them after the fact. So most of it is more of a live setting rather than a, you know, email exchange or correspondence.
Okay.
And before we started the first, so I've been visiting him ever since I moved to the States, which was 2004.
Because you were born in Spain.
I was born in Spain, and I grew up in Europe. I mean, I spent some time in Spain, was in the States for 2 years, then went back to Spain for a year, then lived in Germany for 8 years, then went back to Spain for 5 years, and then decided to move to the States.
So what was your primary language?
It was really bilingual. I mean, my mom's from Madrid, my dad's American, and so I grew up with Spanish and English on a sort of 50-50 basis.
Because I'm not getting any sorts of accents at all.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's probably due to the fact that my dad, you know, I was programmed with the sort of rhythms in the speech of the English language. Yeah,
that's interesting.
Very lucky. And when I went to high school in Germany, it was a little bit odd because all of the people who spoke English there were British, and so that kind of gave me a different angle. Anyway, as part of the prep for the book, as I was mentioning before, I decided to go back and really sort of scour all of the correspondence that I had with Bob, which meant going through, at that time, 15 years of emails. Because I started writing with Bob when I was 19 and I was living in Germany. That was the first time that I sent him a fan letter or I guess fan letter is exactly appropriate, even though it was an email. It was the 15th of August of 1998. And his email was available because there was a site that had been created to talk about his work. And either he or someone else had signed the guest book, and somehow his email got on it. And I quickly, you know, copied it down. It was gone the next day, by the way. I was like, too late. That's it. The damage has been done. And when I was going through that, the sort of the 15 years of collected email, that really was a moment where it crystallized for me that even though, you know, you get into this rhythm when you talk with someone often, when you have regular correspondence, and we'll still trade emails several times a week, every week in and out. But when you see it all put together, it kind of stuns you. It leaves you a little bit, you know, it takes you aback, and you realize, wow, I've been talking with this person. I've been exchanging ideas and, you know, life events, and I lived in different continents while this was going on. I had, you know, I went from being a student to having my first job, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of, you know, life events and thresholds and things like that.
Sure.
So pretty bizarre, pretty surreal, because you never really lose the, but I'm still a fan of your work, you know?
You've got me now thinking about how I could do a similar project with DiNardo. And just take all the emails that DiNardo's ever sent me and put them together in a book and then have him pay me not to ever publish them.
You'd be his Silverberg, wouldn't you?
Because there'd be whole chapters of just, you bastard.
We will not be including those in Traveler of Worlds.
So do you ever do you still go to Worldcon and you go to different conventions and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you ever worry about coming face to face with Jamie Todd Rubin?
I don't.
And having to compete for Robert Silverberg's attention?
I'm very secure in my relationship. Not only that one, but no.
So that's pretty cool. On the back to the novella pieces for a second. So how did it come about that you got to work with Robert Silverberg? Was it instigated by you, by the publisher? Do they pick for you? I mean, how did that whole thing work out?
That's a great question. And
that's why I get paid the big peanuts.
Well, the answer is page 83 of the book.
Really? So
what I mean by that is that in the actual book, in between the two novellas, Bob very graciously wrote this this extremely generous introduction to me. So and in those 4 or 5 pages, he kind of goes into the details of what our relationship was and how the project came about. So just to give you the short version, this was really, as I was mentioning before, sort of a publisher instigated thing where they were looking for, I should say really editor, not publisher. And Mike Resnick was the editor for these books and is the editor for these books. The series continues. So he and Bob have been friends for a very long time. And there is this sort of situation where Bob hasn't been writing a lot of fiction. I don't know if you know that, but for, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, he's produced the occasional story for some high visibility, you know, anthology invitations, but that's pretty much it. Mm. It's not, he doesn't just write freelance particularly. Although you can still find him in, you know, the monthly or Reflections column, every issue of Asimov's and so on and so forth. I mean, even when he's not writing, he's still more prolific than most people. But that's beside the point. He and Mike go back a very long time. Mike Resnick.
Okay.
And so I think that there was some awareness that I had a relationship with Bob. And it wasn't just about pairing any up-and-coming author with a more established pro. It was about finding someone who had a little bit of that mentor relationship, if you will.
Sure.
So my name, you know, was suggested. And the challenge was that Bob didn't want to write a new novella. I mean, he liked the idea that he would do the project with me, but he still needed to deliver a story, and he wasn't willing to write one. So that was a little bit of a hiccup. So really what happened is that he went back and he had this, very rarely for him, he had a project that he'd started work on and had never finished. It was a story that he had set out to tell over the course of 3 long novels.
And oddly enough, that's not very rare for me. Go ahead.
So that's one way in which you being DiNardo Silverberg kind of breaks down a little bit.
Yeah,
but
a little bit, yeah.
We'll continue to find all the parallels. He was planning to do this trilogy, and he sort of had some ideas, a little bit of an outline, but it wasn't quite clear how he was going to get to where he wanted to go. And he'd written maybe the first 100 or so pages of that initial volume, and at some point the whole thing just unraveled, and pretty much, you know, came to a halt. And so when this when the idea for this project came about, he, I remembered that he had done that, and he remembered that he had done that. I get no credit for remembering, but he does. So he went back, and he sort of realized that there was enough material in that first abortive chunk of that novel for that trilogy that never got finished to pull out a strong sort of meaningful novella that could work well as a standalone or have a sequel. And it was very clear where he cut it off, what the sequel needed to be, because as I mentioned before, he put the universe in great peril, and he didn't provide any idea or any suggestion of how that might be undone.
Cool.
It's like, this is a great breaking point. Here you go.
No pressure.
Yeah, so he did his part. That was the other thing, that because he was going back and sort of extracting, polishing, editing something that had existed in a slightly different form before. I think he was done in about 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
So yeah, then it was up to me to start, which was enormously thrilling and an honor.
But sure. Oh, absolutely.
I'll tell you that probably the most meaningful response to me, I mean, I've got some nice, you know, kudos from various people in the community that I deeply respect and whose opinion I value, but it was really his response that was most meaningful to me, because it's one of those things where, you know, you want to get it right, but you really want to get it right and do right by the person that, that has given you the opportunity.
Very cool.
I remember that once I'd finished it, I printed out a hard copy because he would not be reading a soft version. This is one of the, you know, things that you just learn along the way. Mm-hmm. So I physically mailed him the package, and that was an interesting sort of 2 days. And the thing that freaked me out a little bit is, again, one of these idiosyncrasies. He normally does not email on a Sunday. And so there I was on a Sunday. I remember it was the 13th of May of 2012. And I see an email from Bob come through, and I think, oh, this could be really good or really bad. Like, we're not doing the book kind of bad. And I jest, of course, since he, you know, I'm sure he would have, the professionalism would not allow that to happen. But anyway, I opened up the email, and it was highly complimentary, and he had received the package, he had read it, he had really enjoyed it, and he had been moved to turn on his computer and email me on a Sunday.
That's awesome.
You know Bob, so that's probably very, that you know, that says more to you if you know him than if you don't. But,
well, I mean, that's like the best case scenario. The worst case scenario would have been, do you not understand standard manuscript format?
So English is not your native language after all. Right.
1-inch margins. Courier 12 point. Did you not read that memo? No. That's funny. That is really funny. And from there, I mean, you've written other stuff. You've got short fiction in places.
Yep.
Like Analog and yeah. Galaxy's Edge and Apex.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Last year was a really good year. I mean, after the Blue Shift project was done, I sort of wanted to focus on short fiction again. And, you know, more short stories. And last year was a good year. I mean, I think I ended up selling 13 or 14 stories.
Nice.
All of them were pretty much, I think all of them except one or two were to pro magazines. So, yeah, those are some of the markets that you mentioned. I had two stories come out in Journal of Unlikely Entomology. I just love saying that.
And do you consider, like, what's your genre? I mean, are you all over the place? Do you do sci-fi? Do you do hard sci-fi? I mean, what's your passion? Where do you end up when you're writing?
Well, that dovetails perfectly with what I was saying. The
Big peanuts.
The I think that I never really had a plan for it in my mind. The writers that influenced me the most growing up and the people that I used to read were primarily science fiction, but there were also things that were not really classifiable as science fiction or even as anything outside of, you know, good writing or, you know, interesting storytelling, whatever you want to call it. So I think I started off sort of having this undefined idea that I would only write science fiction, but then I would have, notions and things would stimulate me to want to write outside of SF, and that's what I've been doing. So really, the short answer would be all over the place, completely unfocused.
Well, that happens.
And that's why I mentioned those two stories from the Journal of Unlikely Entomology. I'll keep saying that.
What was the story there, though?
Well, those are horror. They're just straight out horror.
Okay.
And they're pretty dark. They're pretty horrific. And you know, it didn't feel odd. It didn't feel strange to write them. There was a specific thing that I wanted to accomplish with each of those stories, and I needed, you know, the horror, feel to do it. And so I went ahead and I did my best.
Very cool.
I can see myself writing fantasy and, even non-fantastic stuff. I mean, I just sold a story to the Mammoth Book of Professor Moriarty Adventures. So that is not science fiction or fantasy at all. It's obviously Sherlock Holmes inspired writing.
Spoilers.
For those of us who don't know who Professor Moriarty is. Absolutely.
Which Moriarty? Is it the Moriarty from the Arthur Conan Doyle books?
Yes.
Is it the Moriarty? Well, no, hold on. I'm not done yet with the bit. Is it the Moriarty from the Sherlock? on BBC? Is it Moriarty from Star Trek The Next Generation?
I wanted to do The Next Generation, but I'm not sure I could have gotten away with that. it's the Moriarty that is extremely popular and well known, so that today we have entire anthologies, such as the Mammoth Book of Professor Moriarty Adventures, dedicated to him. But he actually only appeared twice in the whole Arthur Conan Doyle canon, so that was interesting. Yeah.
Well, and I've said before, one of my favorite anthologies was the one that John Joseph Adams did on it was, what's the name of it?
Are you talking about the Holmes one too?
It was a Sherlock Holmes, but it was like Cthulhu, and science fiction, and it was why can't I remember the name of the freaking anthology? Anyway, people go look it up. It's John Joseph Adams, and just like search John Joseph Adams and Sherlock Holmes, and you'll find it. And it was a great anthology because it had all these different authors telling Sherlock Holmes stories that you would not normally see anywhere else.
That was The Improbable Adventures.
The Improbable Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And, some really great stuff in there. Really, really great stuff. Very different.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of submission guidelines for this one, which is edited by Maxim Jakubowski, is it really had no fantastic element in the guidelines. So, I mean, my story sort of still has a little bit of that vibe to it, I guess. And you could argue, but I won't give you, spoiler alert. You'll have to read it, but there's a little bit of a implied fantastic element.
Well, is this perhaps is this your first ever podcast?
It is.
Okay, so podcast 101. I shouldn't have to ask you a third time for the name of your stories.
The name of the stories.
Come on.
All right. So the story that I'm talking about right now, the Moriarty one, is it's called As Falls Reichenbach, So Falls Reichenbach Falls. Mm-hmm. And what other story titles did you ask me for?
You were talking about, you said there was a couple.
Oh, the Journal of Unlikely Entomology? Mm-hmm. Are those? Yeah. So they were, now you're putting me on the spot after selling all these stories. No, I'm just kidding. The most recent one to appear is called Miranda's Wings. That came out in the November 2014 issue.
Okay.
And the one before that in that particular market was called The Wall Garden. And that came out in November 2013, just 1 year before.
Okay. And what did you have in analog?
I've published a story in analog called Hot and Cold. That came out in the July-August double issue 2014. Mm-hmm. That was very sort of hard SF. It was actually inspired by a physics paper on black hole thermodynamics. And it was one of those things where you sort of, you skip some of the technical stuff, you go to the end and you think, wait a minute, how has this not been done in a story?
So you just let another cat out of the bag here, which is the fact that you are really, really smart. You're a physicist.
Oh, that's what you mean. No, I'm just kidding. I there is that perception that you have to be really, really smart to be a physicist, but there's plenty of counterexamples.
Well, I'm just throwing it out there that it involves a lot of math.
I appreciate the compliment.
Yes,
thank you.
It involves a lot of math.
It does.
So do you agree with Hawking that the Large Hadron Collider is going to destroy the world?
I stopped hearing what you asked when you said, do you agree with Hawking? Because I knew that the answer had to be yes.
Well, there's been a couple of things out there now where he's talking about the stuff that they want to do with the Large Hadron Collider that he thinks it's just going to destroy the world.
Well, Hawking, I think, is very playful in the way he communicates with the media. And, he's also made statements about the dangers of sending out our signals and them being picked up by extraterrestrials and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I think he was the one who put together this. He wanted to really find out if time travel was possible. So he had this thing where he put together a party, but he had only like future dated the invitations or something like that. And no one showed up. he's a fascinating intellectual figure. I was on a panel with, I think it was David Brin once, and it was a physics-related panel. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked him, Mr. Brin, what do you think about Roger Penrose's theory on blah, blah, blah? And then it was like a 10-minute, you know, dissertation. It was a very, very technical question. And I was just sort of observing, thinking, oh, I'm sure I can learn from Mr. Brin how to handle that particular type of question. And he handled it beautifully. He said something like, what I find remarkable is that Roger Penrose is a member of the human species. He's a human being. And he just sort of went on the beauty of science and, you know, to your point, intellect and things like that. So
which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did you fall for science fiction, which then made you want to do science and be a physicist, or did it go the other way around? Like you're in this world and you're doing physicisty things, which I assume are exactly the way they are portrayed on The Big Bang Theory. And then as you're standing there in your Flash t-shirt, you thought, hey, maybe I should do some science fiction stuff too. You know, which came first?
It was the Flash t-shirt that came first. No, I think I've always been interested in storytelling. And so the impulse to tell stories is really what came first.
But did you love science fiction?
And then
did that guide you, or did that make you want to be a scientist? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was really more about science fiction is showing me things. It's giving me access to realms of experience that are not readily available to me in my quotidian life. And so when I'm reading these stories and, you know,
hold on, I got to look that word up.
Big peanuts. Particularly as a, you know, impressionable youngster, your suspension of disbelief is, you know, there's just no limit to it. So you'll read a science fiction or a fantasy story or whatnot, and you're truly in that world, in that story. And so you feel like the author is taking you on a tour of all of these wonders that, again, you normally would not be able to experience. And I think that it was the impulse to sort of see things or understand parts of the universe that you can't readily get to through your, you know, normal perceptions. That was the impulse that led me to want to study physics. Because it was the same thing. I thought, well, physics handles the very large and the very small, and I don't deal with those a lot in my everyday life.
And when you're writing science fiction, does the physics work itself into it? Do you end up going with harder sci-fi, or do you end up going with more fantasy elements in your sci-fi?
It really depends on the particular type of effect that I'm trying to create with the story, or what I'm setting the story out to do. So, I can think of both examples. Like in the case we were talking about before, this first analog sale, it was very, the physics was actually the starting point. And the story grew out of, well, what would happen if you actually had characters in the situation? You know, how would they handle this really extreme scenario? And I sort of backed into the world building because of the original premise. But for the most part, I'd say that the story ideas that I get are probably a little bit more centered on character and sort of some kind of emotional tone or dynamic. And all of the other stuff, including the science, is one element that is a part of that world building.
Okay. I've always found it fascinating that you can have two people like sitting on the couch next to each other watching Star Trek, the original series, as children. And the person on the left watches that and says, I want to be a scientist and I want to be an engineer and I want to build things and I want to get us to the moon. And the other person on the couch is sitting there going, this is so cool. I want to learn karate.
Absolutely.
You know, I want to learn the nerve pinch, or, you know, how to chop someone in the head that way.
Well, when you see Sulu fencing like that, I mean,
right.
that's a pretty strong motivator.
I always find it interesting, you know, how people find the path to the things that they do. So everybody says that they write character-driven stories. I'm not trying to slam you on that. You know, everybody talks about that because a lot of the editors and publishers are like, oh, well, we want character-driven stories. And in the background, the marketing department's going, no, we need action.
Right.
We need adventure.
Right.
And so that's kind of why I put that question out there a little bit. I'm just curious because, you know, I personally have a hard time with hard sci-fi. And it is because when it starts to go into those details of physics or goes into the details of the math, that's when my brain shuts off and I just want the shiny.
The shiny is all is that's what it's all about, Patrick. The shiny. Wasn't that a Stephen King novel?
No, that's The Shining.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Thank you. All this time.
Which anyway. I live near there.
No kidding.
That place is like 2 hours from my house.
So do you, I've been there. Really?
Yes, I've been to the Stanley. It's called the Stanley. It's the Stanley Inn.
Yeah.
And you can actually go up there. It's really difficult to get the room that he stayed in. That's typically booked months, if not years in advance, because people want to stay in that room. But they do, and this is a completely weird tangent. They have a medium on staff. She has her own office. I kid you not. They have a museum to all the various film versions of, because they did the original movie with Kubrick, and then they did the television one.
Right.
And so they have all this stuff there. They do ghost tours. You can actually go up there. And the ghost hunters from the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi, like, you know how they had the A players on that show, and then they had the B players on that show, and then they had the C players on that show, and they kind of would mix them every once in a while. These are the Z players. These are the people that you never actually saw on camera, but they're loosely associated with TAPS, and they will actually take you, you know, through the different places that the TAPS teams have gone throughout the years and recorded stuff, and you can pay for that. And then, if I'm not mistaken, they can also give you a coupon to get your sewer like roto-rooted out. So,
you know, the fact that room is the room that is that booked so yes. so much in advance, that's a nice little commentary about our contemporary society, right? Mm-hmm. There.
Well, and it's also interesting, the music room, the last time I was up there, the music room was actually roped off and they don't let people in there. They had it for the season or something. They were doing something. They were restoring some stuff in there. And there's like a couple of places that are supposedly the most haunted. And those are the ones that they kind of had blocked off and you couldn't go through them at that time. But I will say, I think I did see a ghost. It was our waiter. We were in the restaurant and we ordered brunch, and then we never saw him again. So I'm not sure that he was an actual real person. He may have just been a ghost.
Was the food real?
The food was real. Late.
it was real crappy. No.
Yeah, and the glasses, the liquid in the glasses was gone, and then never got refilled. It was strange. It was just really weird. I knew someone who honeymooned up there, which I think is very strange, and they did that during a remodel, and the husband, the newlywed husband, goes in the bathroom, and they had this wall of windows kind of thing in the shower bathroom thing, and no blinds, no curtains, no anything. And he turned around, he went to his wife. He's like, "We're not showering in there. People can see us." It was, I don't know. But it is a neat place. It's a very cool place. And you can go up there and see it.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that in my case, one of the reasons that I don't focus as much on the science as maybe my sort of academic background might lead one to believe is that the type of science fiction that I really cut my teeth on was really new wave stuff, and there was not a whole lot of science in that.
Okay.
It was a lot of psychology, you know, sociology, things like that. Mm-hmm. But there was not a lot of like equations or you know, detail, to your point, what you were saying before. There's not a lot of very complex math or anything like that would happen in those stories. And those are some of the authors that really moved me and inspired me when I was discovering science fiction as a teenager. You know, Silverberg, obviously, but then there were other writers like Maltzberg or Spinrad or Ballard. And none of them had a lot of science in their stories. So I think that the imprint for what an awesome story is in the back of my mind is somewhat molded by those early experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps, hopefully, to keep a little bit of that. Maybe that leads me closer to the path towards the true shiny.
Cool. Very cool. So what's next for you? I mean, you've got the Silverberg stuff. You sold 13 stories last year. Are you going for 26 this year?
Well, I'm working full time, and I was doing some more part time work and freelance stuff last year. That was part of the reason I think I had a little bit of more free time. My main goals right now are to continue moving forward on the Conversations book with Bob that we talked about mm-hmm. before.
Yeah.
I'd like to continue to sell as many stories as possible. I have some stories that I've sold that are going to be coming out. One of them is called The Romance of Flying on Dead Languages. And it's going to be coming out in a new magazine launching, I think, in June or July called Bahamut Journal. I have another story coming out in Galaxy's Edge. It's called The Rose is Obsolete. I have a couple of stories coming out in anthologies. I mentioned the Moriarty one. I have another one called And Now You Are Alone Among the Stars, which is more of an experimental story. It's coming out in an anthology edited by Rose Lemberg called An Alphabet of Embers. Cool. Sold another story to Analog, Endless Forms Most Beautiful. I just did the galleys for that one. That's coming out in the September 2015 issue. What else?
What'd you sell to Apex?
I actually sold the thing that I most recently sold to Apex was a poem called, is a long poem called Conservation of Energy, which is which got nominated for a Riesling. So I'm really, really excited about that.
That's awesome. Yeah. Good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, and I don't want to put any pressure on you, but in the time that it's taken us to record this podcast, Ken Liu has already written 13 stories.
Absolutely. When you look at people like Jay Lake or Ken Liu, et cetera, our field has impossible bench posts. So they're a great inspiration.
Yes, they are.
Alex Schwartzman is extremely prolific too. And I collaborated on a story with him that we sold to Nature, which was a fantastic experience. It's in his debut collection of short stories, Explaining Cthulhu to Grandma and Other Stories, which just came out. Great title, right?
Yeah, that is.
I think I mentioned, let's see. Oh yeah. I have another one called Gate of Sun, Gate of Moon, which is coming out in an anthology titled, Ruins Excavation, which is a sort of archaeology, sci-fi story.
Okay.
So that was a lot of fun to write because again, if you've read Bob's stuff and, you're a little bit familiar with some of his fiction, he's written some of these stories that have archaeologists as characters, and he loved archaeology, and he wrote several really interesting nonfiction books about it too. So it was a blast to write that story.
Now on the science side, as we're recording this today, I just saw an article at lunchtime that said that scientists at the Large Hadron Collider had actually proved the existence of the Force.
I believe that there is a distinct possibility that that was an April Fool's, but wanting to be open-minded, we'd have to do a little bit more investigating. Yeah, I saw that. That was awesome.
It was, yes. And the other one that I really liked was the Smithsonian released a video where they now have on display Wonder Woman's invisible jet.
I missed that. That's fantastic. Missed that.
Go to DiNardo's Twitter feed, SF Signal. Yeah. And he linked it there. It was and he credited me because I sent it to him first. I'm like, look this, check this out, and it is pretty good because I mean they even got the guy like up there dusting it.
Nature just had a really one that I liked a lot too. They had a headline about how they had found evidence that dragons were real and they had originally led to climate change back in the 15th century or whatever, and people were like, is really.
Probably my favorite of the day so far really has been Microsoft releases MS-DOS for mobile.
Oh, I saw that. The picture was priceless.
It was wonderful. And then the other one, I probably did like the Google Maps turns into Pac-Man.
Oh, yeah.
And you can play Pac-Man. And so I totally went to my house on Google Maps and started playing Pac-Man all around my house. It was wonderful. I was having so much fun. Yeah, that killed productivity in so many offices today. It's not even funny.
Did you see the one on Amazon?
Yes. In fact, I saw it when I went to search your name on Amazon just to see if there was anything like new and upcoming. And it pulled up and it went, Amazon's gone retro. And I'm looking at the screen going, what the hell?
Well, the funny thing is I've been having issues with two websites. One of them is Amazon and the other one is Blu-ray.com. And there was something, I think that one of my cookies or whatever got damaged. And so what I've been experiencing for the last few days is I'll load these websites and they'll start to load, but I'll only get like chunks and pieces of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to refresh several times and I've done all the standard troubleshooting and I think I finally fixed it. But it was just in the wake of that issue where the page wasn't loading correctly and it was kind of reverting to that retro format anyway, that I went to it today and I clicked on it. And I'm like, well, it is retro, but I can see all the links, which is kind of weird. It took me a second to get it. Yeah, that was
pretty good. So do you travel? Do you like to go to conventions other than Worldcon? Do you ever hit any local cons?
Worldcon is really the main one. I'm hoping to go to World Fantasy Con. Mm. It has been suggested to me that I would greatly enjoy the experience of going to ICFA. So I'll probably hit that up at some point.
Should send an email to Karen Burnham. I think she runs that.
Yes, absolutely. And conventions are also good because I've now gotten to this place where on the side I'm interviewing people, you know, mm-hmm. as well for various places. Obviously I've done some for SF Signal. You may have seen those, but mm-hmm. I've also been doing a number of interviews for Clark's World. That started up last year and it's been really exciting. I've got to, you know, interact with some wonderful people.
Have you gotten to talk to The Voice?
Who's The Voice?
Kate Baker.
Oh, yeah.
She's The Voice.
I didn't know that she was The Voice.
Yes, I tell her every time she's The Voice.
Well, that makes sense now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we correspond, and she's the nonfiction editor. Mm-hmm. So I've had some nonfiction come out of Clark's World as well. And as a matter of fact, since we're on the subject, today the new issue launched, the April issue, and it has a very, very long roundtable conversation that I did over the last few weeks with some of Spain's top science fiction and fantasy writers.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun to work on. I think it's maybe 7,000 or 8,000 words long. So not to discourage any readers, but
well, roundtables can be just a blast. I mean, that's kind of the heart of what we do here.
Right.
And I know I'm taking a little break right now and I've been doing more interviews, but that is fun. I mean, it's what I love to do.
So that's one of the reasons that I love cons. Also, I'm editing the blog for Locus magazine.
Okay.
And meeting various people makes it very easy to say, hey, would you like to do a guest post on the blog?
Yep. Which is a double-edged sword because then they actually do.
Right. They're like, well, do I know you again? But, that has been, interesting because I officially have the editor, you know, kind of role on that one. And it's a skill set that I've never really used in the past, so it's been a lot of fun to try to learn the ropes and not do too much damage. I'm also writing reviews for Intergalactic Medicine Show.
Very cool. Okay.
I have that going on as well.
And so you're going to be in Spokane?
Absolutely.
And I'll agree with whoever said that you would enjoy ICFA. I think you would. I think you'd also enjoy World Fantasy. It's kind of ironic. World Fantasy is one of my favorite conventions, and I've only been to one. But it had such an impact on me, and I just loved it so much. It's just I haven't been able to go again due to other things. You know, it's kind of like I have to decide. Do I want to go to World Fantasy or do I want to go to Worldcon? And I kind of end up going to Worldcon. So it's like, you know, I can afford one big trip and that's it.
Right. Yeah.
But Mile High Con's the other one that I like. And then, cause of course that's local to me. So, if you ever come to Mile High Con, you know, I can totally take you up to the Stanley, leave you there overnight, see what happens.
Maybe I'll find that waiter for you.
Do you have a website of your own?
I do. The website where you can find me, probably the easiest thing is just to type in the word Aineko, A-I-N-E-K-O, into Google and my name or part of my name. It's myaineko.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. And that will give you updates. It has a little bibliography section. You'll see my blog and nonfiction, et cetera, et cetera. It's all on there.
That's two strikes now because you're in California and you use Blogspot. Twitter, Facebook?
Yep. Twitter, A. Zina Samaro, Facebook, Oliver Zina Samaro. You see this theme here. Mm-hmm. Google Plus as well, LinkedIn, Goodreads. I think I'll stop there. It's exhausting already.
Yeah. Pinterest, Instagram.
Instagram, MySpace. Just started that up. What's MySpace? I've never heard of that one.
You don't have a MySpace account with all your favorite emo bands on it? Come on.
Email bands. Now that's a term
emo.
I haven't heard. Oh, emo bands. Both of those are terms I haven't heard in a while, but yeah.
I had a cousin once tell me that he was starting an emo Christian rock band, and I went, everything that just came out of your mouth makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Okay, so
what else you got for me?
Anything? Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before I let you go? Because it's you know, I'm coming up on time here. I told you I would only keep you for a certain amount of time, and I'm running out. So this is your chance. Is there anything else you want to tell people?
I really appreciate that you had me on the podcast.
No problem. That's me. That's me. You're not telling the people anything.
No, I'm telling them that I appreciate you having me on.
Well, I'm glad that you're a fan. We're going to have you on more often, and I just wish you all the success in the world. I think it's great that I think you do have a plan with your career path as far as writing, and it sounds to me like you're just going to keep going up.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
No problem. So go check out all his stuff. Check out his website. Check out Twitter and Facebook, and check out those Robert Silverberg books. Thanks, Alvaro.
Ton of fun. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF&F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
It's like talking to a child.
Magic wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
I don't even know what the horseman is.
And scene, you bastard.